So this is Tell It Like It Is with Christina Malasoff and my co-host Kieran Riley. Tell It Like It is on every Thursday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. And it is on WGXC Community Radio. And only WGXC Community Radio makes it possible for voices such as Dr. Jill Stein to be heard.
No corporate sponsors here. Jill Stein is Dr. Jill Stein, mother, physician, teacher of internal medicine, pioneering environmental health advocate, and currently running for president on the Green Party line. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jill Stein.
It's really great to be with you, and big shout out to the wonderful work that you are doing at Tell It Like It Is, because there aren't very many who are standing up to Tell It Like It Is. So thank you so much for doing that work that you do every day.
Thank you for that. Dr. Stein, considering today we are entering, especially in upstate New York City and upstate, we are being hit by Hurricane Sandy. One of the things that was glaringly left out of the presidential debates, besides yourself, was the issue of climate change. And I was wondering if you could talk about climate change and how that fits in the Green Party platform along with the idea of ecological economics.
Great. Thank you. And I think this is exactly why I was not left out of the debate, but very actively suppressed out of the debate, because they cannot afford to acknowledge what's going on, the role of the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party in creating this catastrophe that we continue to hurl towards, you know, at breakneck speed. And they have no plan to alter this disastrous course that we're on. So, of course, it is very dangerous for them to acknowledge this crisis. And that is very much why we need to break open this this stranglehold on our democracy, on our environmental policies, and on our climate as well. So, you know, to address the first part of your question, what is going on with the climate, this is a case in point. And what's really quite sobering is that this is just a taste of what's to come. What we've seen in this storm now, which is the second, you know, storm of the century that we've seen in 2 years after Irene last year, now we have another record-breaking storm 2 years in a row. Over the last 12 months, we've seen the hottest 12 months on record. We've seen the record destruction of forests and forest fires resulting from the record drought, which has impacted two-thirds of continental United States. Many of those areas, for the second year in a row, we're seeing real severe water shortages. As a consequence, we're looking at significantly rising food costs in a country where already millions of people, some 40-some million actually, are already on food aid to start with because they cannot afford to feed their families. Now we're looking at further skyrocketing of food prices. We're looking at the melting of the Arctic reduced by 75% from where it was just a couple decades ago, and in fact reduced many decades ahead of schedule to the shambles of an ice sheet that we see right now. So this is clearly perilous, and we've gotten here with less than 1 degree centigrade of climate warming over the past couple centuries, yet because of the acceleration that's now currently in place, we're looking at 6 degrees of warming before the century is out. So, you know, it's no, this is no trivial matter. This is not something we cannot afford to neglect, suppress, and otherwise overlook. So our campaign has made fixing this climate crisis a priority, the central priority of our campaign. We are calling for a Green New Deal, which you may have seen a little bit about in reading about our campaign.
Right.
And it basically is an emergency solution to the climate crisis at the same time that it solves the economic crisis. It creates 25 million jobs to end unemployment at the same time that it transitions us to that green economy that spells a halt to climate change. And the benefits, the side benefits, are that it makes wars for oil obsolete, which means we can bring hundreds of billions of dollars back into the economy to basically pay for this green transition. And it also, importantly, creates a real structure for health in our communities, because doing what's right for the climate also turns out to be doing exactly what we need to protect our health so we're not getting sick in the first place. And that is pollution prevention through a clean energy system, getting rid of that air pollution which drives asthma, heart disease, strokes, and all the rest, getting rid of this industrialized food system and transitioning to a sustainable, local, healthy, organic food system, which is what your mother and your grandmother told you you needed to be eating, those fresh fruits and vegetables anyhow, to truly protect your health. And in fact, they are right. And the third component is public transportation, mm-hmm. including active transit in the form of safe sidewalks and safe bike paths, so we can get our exercise on the way to work, school, and business. Once you've integrated exercise into the community, so you don't have to go out and purchase that expensive health club membership and drive for an hour to get your exercise safely. Instead, we integrate it into our transit system, and those components of the green economy together create not only the jobs we need, the climate we need, make worse for oil obsolete, but that also creates real infrastructure for a real healthcare system instead of this sick care system where 75% of our sick care dollars, I should say of our healthcare dollars, in fact, are spent treating chronic diseases that can be prevented at a tiny fraction of the cost. So all of this is windfall benefit from moving to the green economy, which is something that we must do as an emergency matter right now.
Well, Dr. Stein, this is fantastic. I'm a registered green, just in full disclosure. How does this fit with the paradigm right now of our economy right now of constant growth? And how do we make that shift when everything is being controlled by major corporations, especially if people listen to the radio today and they listen to Democracy Now? We're talking about Bill McKibben was talking about basically how the oil companies are holding the entire world ransom. How do we organize in the face of that? How do we make this shift to this economy, to this vision that you were just talking about?
Great. And that is really the question of the day. How do we stand up and break this stranglehold of the predatory special interests, the oil companies, the natural gas, the fracking, which is coming online, as well as the stranglehold of the big banks, you know, who are invested in this stuff and who have a real lockdown on our economy, as well as how do we break the stranglehold of the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and so on. You know, for every crisis we face, there is a very powerful predator that has gotten us here, that has bought off our political system, and which is dedicated to driving every last nail into the coffin for us public in order to squeeze every last dollar of profit out of the system. So, you know, that's the bad news. But the good news is that you add up the millions of people who don't have health care, even under Obamacare, which mm-hmm. I live with in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and which has definitely not solved the problem. It's just it's a step to the side. It's not really a step forward. It benefits one group and it hurts many others. People are going bankrupt at the same rate as before. We are still as sick as ever, and the costs continue to skyrocket. So this is really a bait and twist. This is a distraction. So we got millions of people who are locked out of health care. You look at 36 million students and recent graduates who are indentured servants who do not have a future. I mean, to my mind, this is the real power for change. It's what brought us the revolutions, the democracy revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt, where a young man, a college-educated man, could not have a job, could not even get a permit to sell his stuff on the street, lit himself on fire, and that just spread like a wildfire because young people across Tunisia and then Egypt and other areas are fighting the same battle, and you know what? They're fighting that battle here, too, where 36 million students are effectively indentured servants without a future, facing 50% unemployment and underemployment, even while they carry these unforgiving, draconian loans. So that is your power right there.
Yeah.
So turn politics on its head right now. by simply flicking that switch in our minds, we've been told for a decade and longer that we dare not stand up and vote our values. We dare not stand up with the courage that's out there on the street blocking the Keystone Pipeline, insisting that students be bailed out, not the bank, that to fight the tuition hike, the blockades of evictions, the Occupy protests, mm-hmm. the Chicago Teachers Union. There is a rebellion that is in full swing out of the grassroots, and in poll after poll, the American public supports these basic solutions for peace, justice, democracy, and an economy that works for everyday people, not for the big corporations and the banks. So there's enormous public support to actually move these things forward. The one weapon they have is this psychological war that has talked a lot of people into giving up their vote, into practicing that politics of fear that votes for the lesser evil. But finally, we have now 10 years of experience with lesser evilism on the record, and we see right. exactly what its track record is. And the truth is, the politics of fear, guess what, folks? It brought us everything we were afraid of, all those things we were supposed to vote for lesser evil in order to avoid: the expanding war, the attack on our civil liberties, the continued outsourcing of our jobs, the undermining of our wages, the attack on collective bargaining rights, which has been shared every bit as much by the Democrats and this White House as by the Republicans, although the Democrats are a little bit less blatant about it. But the same principles are in operation. They've greatly exceeded the Republicans in the Wall Street bailouts, in the continued offshoring of our jobs
right.
and trade agreements, the attack on our civil liberties, the attack on immigrant rights, the attack on public education, and the allowing student debt.
Well, the great irony is that many people who had so much hope for Obama actually got much worse in the end. However, I've heard many people say to me that they would wind up voting for Obama, at least in New York State, because of the idea of a Democrat making the next Supreme Court appointment versus next two appointments versus a Republican. How does that factor into anything?
That's hogwash, actually. That's part of the propaganda campaign to talk you out of your power. In fact, look at Obama's appointments right now. Sonia Sotomayor has a rather questionable record on abortion rights, and one of her more notable decisions actually denied abortion rights to women who were being denied them. So it's not at all clear where she and Elena Kagan, for that matter, are going to come down. And look at their track record on SB 1070, the worst provision of the show me your papers part of that anti-immigrant bill was upheld unanimously. On the other hand, there have been some appointments from Republicans which have really stood up for women's rights and for democracy and against money and politics and all those things. So you can't predict. And besides, the Supreme Court does not create a social movement. The Supreme Court is not going to save us from the climate disaster or from the continued offshoring of our jobs and so on. The Supreme Court cannot do what it takes. We need a social movement which is broad, which is in the streets, which is in the polls, and which will drive the change in Supreme Court.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Thank you, Dr. Jill Stein. So on more on that note, you talked about Occupy, you talked about the Arab Spring a little bit. Amongst at least my friends, there seems to be a lot of dissatisfaction with the electoral system in general after Citizens United, money becoming free speech, the banksters basically running our entire electoral system, including the Electoral College. People in New York really don't need to vote because they decided that New York State is voting for Obama. I'm just wondering, how does the Green Party fit into reaching these people, the Occupy movement, for example? You were arrested, as a matter of fact, in front of the debates, and House Resolution 347, which criminalizes protest, which I had no idea till recently, or the anti-Occupy bill, it's pretty serious stuff, making it a felony for anyone to cause any disturbance where the Secret Service or any political candidate is running for office. Talk about your arrest, your ideas of civil disobedience, and can the Green Party help galvanize the movement you're talking about that is necessary to overcome this major corporate capitalist state?
Exactly, and I think you've described it so well that we have seen this acceleration under the Obama administration of the attack on our civil liberties. But what Occupy with the coordinated attack that we're all using the same talking points with militarized police in full riot gear surrounding, you know, peaceful encampments with helicopters overhead in some cases, and with the same script being followed in those brutal police attacks. And then to learn that this is being coordinated by the Obama White House, by the FBI and Homeland Security, by Obama's embrace of the Patriot Act, his renewal of it without any reform, his signing of H.R. 347, as you pointed out, the criminalization of protests, add to that the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that allows the president to assume dictatorial powers to put any of us in jail at his will and pleasure without a charge, without a trial. This is an attack, an absolute assault on the most basic of American liberties. It's just stunning. And, you know, I think this is part of what is galvanizing people. And over the course of our campaign, we saw an enormous transition in the Occupy movement. Initially, the Occupy movement, for reasons I completely understand, wanted an arm's length from any political campaign because traditional politics is predatory, and the wolves were at their door and still are at their door, looking to either co-opt them, and if not co-opt them, then arrest them. You know, that's what traditional politics is doing to Occupy. But over the course of the campaign, once Occupy got busted, I really saw their tune changed dramatically. Not everyone, because Occupy is a diverse movement, and mm-hmm. it's inherently a social movement, not a political movement. But as individuals, people within the Occupy movement have become very involved and enthusiastic in our campaign, and actually in the Green Party all over the country, where many occupiers are actually running for office as Greens, particularly down in the state of Texas. And I think what happened was that Occupy realized it's not just elections that are rigged, it's actually, you know, protests that are rigged. There is not a single playing field out there that is not deeply tilted against the public interest. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't fight it, you know? We have to fight it all the more, and we have to fight it on every battlefront. This election has enormous wake-up power, and I think it's that wake-up which is the answer to repealing these offenses, repealing the NDAA provisions, repealing H.R. 347, repealing the authorization of military force that Obama interprets to give him the power to assassinate anyone, including U.S. citizens, anywhere, anytime, and their children, I might add, which is what he has already done.
Right.
So, you know, it's galvanizing public opinion, and, you know, because this is done. This is done under the radar. That's the only way they can get away with it. The public will be up in arms across the political spectrum about this. And that's what gives me so much hope, that there are so many people right now who are on the record supporting restoring our civil liberty, our jobs, a green economy, health care, the human right to Medicare for all, bringing the troops home and downsizing the military. This is what we can achieve. And bailing out the students, not the banks, and making public higher education free. These are specific solutions that are on the table. These are growing the party right now, and will continue to grow the party in a way that I think, for me, it feels like we have already won this election. There are more than one way to win it, and winning it by reclaiming our political voice, by reclaiming our political courage and our political momentum. That is the real win. Whatever the vote count is, in a rigged system, don't worry too much about the vote count. What really counts is growing the movement, and growing the fight, and growing the political vehicle for bringing that fight into the voting booth for the long haul. On that count, we have already won.
Well, Dr. Stein, what I want to ask, you know, this is a great segue, is this, you say we've already won, and I have been an active Green, but I was given by our station manager some numbers here, and it says in Green County, the WGXC serves both Columbia and Green counties, there are 61 active Greens, inactive 12, and in Columbia County, 171 active, 19 inactive. and total enrollments of 30,000 and 43,000 respectively. And statewide, total of 22,000 total, roughly. And my question is, in Columbia County, 7 years ago, I was meeting once a week, at a local pub, talking about what we could do on a local level and a national level. And I want you to give me hope right now. Galvanize me. Tell me what you can say to me and the public. As a spokesperson, I'll throw one more thing in: is this the reality of you actually becoming president when the two-party system is rather entrenched? So how do we get this
duopoly
to mess with all, and how do we build this base? Because I don't feel as enthusiastic as you do about the base, and what kind of work are the Greens actually doing to get out, to reach out to people?
Great. Wonderful questions. And that is very much the game plan of this race. I got into the race myself. I've always been a local, bottom-up person working at the local and state level. But when Obama put Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid on the chopping block last August in 2011 as the solution to the debt ceiling crisis,
right.
For me, that was the breaking point. And I said to myself, oh, my God, now I get why people wanted to have a national party. Because I always felt, we got to build locally first. But suddenly I understood the importance of not letting an outrageous thing like that go unchallenged. And the reality is, it is only the Green Party that has survived this decade of fear campaign and smear campaign that's been conducted against independent third parties. It's just the Green Party that was beaten back over the past decade. It was the Labor Party. It was the New Party. It was the Socialist Party and the Peace and Freedom Party that used to have national voices. But since Bush-Nader Gore and that whole fear campaign began insensibly against anyone who dared to stand up for their values, to stand up against the politics of fear, that really demolished independent parties across the board. And I think it's a real sign of strength, a sign of incredible commitment and backbone, that the Green Party survived to fight another day. So we are coming back from, a position of really having been beaten down, but we were the most strong party of all the others. We were the one party that was able to revive in this campaign, get us on the ballot for 85% of voters, get us to federal matching funds, which was historic. Never happened before for an actual member of the Green Party. We are seeing state parties revive again where they never existed. All kinds of people come back to revive the local chapters that had gone dormant, to create new chapters. We are springing up in colleges and universities. That is probably our strongest growing demographic right now, our young people who get that their goose is cooked by the Democrats and Republicans, that it's only the Greens that are really talking an agenda for the younger generation, really looking at generational justice. So, I had expected this to be the most bitter, vicious, difficult campaign I had ever been a part of, but it's actually been exactly the opposite, because as Greens, we've been ahead of the curve, but now suddenly the curve has caught up to us. The public gets this thing about green economies, about climate change, about stopping corporate personhood and a constitutional amendment to do that, and getting money out of politics and electoral reforms, all those things that we've been talking about for decades, suddenly the public, particularly the Occupy movement, is echoing with incredible appreciation. So, in my view, this campaign has been like giving out candy, and when people come in, they don't just come in for November 6th. They're coming in for the long haul, and the energy that is driving the campaign now is just astounding and staggering. And in the polls, we're doing now at least 20 times better than what we've achieved in previous elections. So this is a pretty dramatic step forward. When the campaign is over, we will be rolling right over into building the party with the momentum of the campaign and focusing actually on municipal races where the party is strongest. And there are great areas in New York, in California, in Illinois, in Maine, in Texas, in Massachusetts. There are areas all over the country where we have very strong inroads into municipal government that we'll be building on as our next vehicle for growing this political movement. Because you're absolutely right. There's only so much you can do with a presidential race under the current, in the current climate.
Right.
However, I don't want to, you know, while I'm not holding my breath that we're going to win, I'm not ruling it out either, because
right.
who in their right mind would have expected Tahrir Square and Tunisia to go the way they did, absolutely without warning. If we went viral among students, 36 million indentured servants, basically, they could get out. If they knew that they could put an end to student debt and put an end to the skyrocketing tuition and make public higher education free, whether we win the office or we simply win the day by driving these solutions forward, either way it's a win. If that goes out and gets viral, who knows where this will go? And I think we don't want to sell ourselves short. The important thing is that it can be a win. And your last question about how would it work if we won in the presidency? The truth is, the public supports this agenda by substantial majorities. One out of every two voters is expected to stay home because Obama and Romney give them nothing to come out for. One out of every two voters in polls actually say third party, and they seriously would consider voting for one. So, you know, there's a lot of public will out there. And on people support by substantial majorities, healthcare is a human right, downsizing the military, taxing the rich, breaking up the big bank, creating jobs, not just giving tax breaks to the so-called job creators to send jobs to China, which is what the current economic policies are all about. So the public actually supports it. And what a president could do, if she wanted, a president could be not simply the commander-in-chief, but could actually be the organizer-in-chief. And you know how the SOPA bill and the PIPA bill were stopped. They were stopped on a dime about 2 weeks after word got out that these horrible bills were going to censor the Internet. People got on the phone. They showed up at congressional offices, and they sent emails. And our representatives were told in no uncertain terms that they needed to represent us. No one is in a better position than the president to be a whistleblower on Congress and to let everyday people know what bills are coming up. So, for example, say there's a bill coming up next week to repeal the NDAA and actually restore our right to a trial.
National Defense Workers Union.
To break up the big banks and bail out the students instead of the banks, you know, and provide the reasoning concisely as to why that benefits us, while failing to do that is a disaster. It guarantees that we are headed for another crash. The last one cost us 40% of the average American savings. And we can't afford to do that again, yet we are headed straight for it. You know, and the president can make this clear and simple and send people, you know, turn them loose to instruct their representatives how to represent them one bill at a time. And doing that, we can harness the power of public opinion that we already have to be the real driver of our democracy that we must have if we are going to get out of here alive.
Thank you, Jill. My sense of the debates between Obromney was pretty much like, who's going to bail out the banks better? Who's going to have better friends with the Federal Reserve? And who is going to extend the American empire farther and more effectively? And that's what they were really arguing about. And I just wanted to comment that I thought you and Rocky Anderson kicked their butts on foreign policy. I'm sorry. I got to say, I really appreciate you guys speaking up for truth, justice, and really for peace. You know, peace has become almost a dirty word sometimes. People are so afraid of whatever they're afraid of out there, China or Al-Qaeda or whatnot. But really, I just had one quick question about the students. What I always had this idea, and this is out of left field, but what if collectively, you know, 75% of all students in $50,000 of debt or more just decided on one day, everyone at the same time, to default on their loan payments? Something like that. Collective consciousness, collective action. I feel like the Occupy movement changed the national conversation a little bit on that level. And do you think that as a public, as students, as a young growing movement of which the Green Party is you're keeping alive. Do you think it's really possible right now? And just comment on that if you don't mind.
Great. Good question. And I think that is definitely an option, and we need to seriously look into that and the legal implications. And I would want to understand it a little bit better before giving people the go-ahead to
right.
do it. But I think it's definitely an option that has to be kept on the table. And it is a last resort, but it's definitely an option. In my view, this is the right thing to do. And it's outrageous that we've allowed our younger generation to be, sentenced to this indentured servant status for the indefinite future. This didn't happen by accident. These were horrendous loans that were stripped of usual consumer protections. And it really illustrates what a predatory political system we have that has essentially treated an entire generation as a cash cow. And young people are just the latest cash cow that didn't have campaign contributions, that didn't have a lobbyist to write a bill for them. So, it's absolutely outrageous that this has happened in the same way that the climate catastrophe is being thrust onto their heads, in the same way that their tuition has skyrocketed so that we could fight these wars for oil, these fights for expanding markets, these wars that are really so pointless and unnecessary, and also the big tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, which are also unnecessary. So there's no excuse for it. Right now, the Federal Reserve is bailing out the banks, really for the fourth time, billions of dollars. Now they're spending $40 billion every month to the QE3. That is, we are buying up useless bank debt to get it off their books, because these are the fraudulent securities created by their predatory mortgages, which they peddled onto mortgagees, and then they peddled onto their clients who purchased these, and then they bet against these fraudulent securities. So this is outrageous. The banks built it. They need to own it, and they need to be broken up in any case. So instead of bailing out the banks yet again and acquiring their useless securities, we should be bailing out the students and purchasing their debt and simply forgiving it. It's much smaller than what we've already paid to the bank many times over, and it really unleashes true economic power. It unleashes the genius, the creativity, the imagination of the younger generation. We need them to reboot the economy every generation, but they are locked into service jobs at McDonald's and as temps and, other low-wage, insecure jobs if they have them at all. They need to be turned loose as the entrepreneurs, as the creative working force that they can be and that we need in order to have the economy of the future. So this is absolutely the right thing to do.
Dr. Stein, I know that you have to go soon, but in wrapping up, coming back to the fact that you are running for president on the Green Party ticket, I want to bring it back to two things. One is the idea of can we maintain constant growth, and can we continue living the way we're living right now with our rate of use of natural resources, and I wanted to juxtapose that with another question I really wanted to fit in, which is the Budget Control Act or the issue of sequestration, because right now what's coming down the line with either candidate is the excuse for basically wholesale ransacking of programs to serve people and to basically use the sequestration as an excuse for austerity in this country, much the same that's being battled right now in Europe. So if you could just talk just briefly about that, because I know you've got to go.
Great.
Thank you.
Great, terrific, wonderful question, and I'll just say in brief that sequestration and austerity have a track record. That track record is evident not only in the failing economies of Europe that continue to fail with austerity, but also in what got us into the Great Depression to start with. We were in a severe recession. They tried austerity measures, and it catapulted us into the Great Depression. So there's very clear evidence that it's absolutely the wrong thing to do. And I should mention that the Democrats are completely in cahoots with the Republicans here. It's not just a Republican plan. It's a Democratic plan as well. They have the same, the same cuts in mind. The Ryan budget called for like $5 trillion in budget cuts. The Obama budget, he's talking about $4 trillion. A little bit of it would be tax increases, but the vast bulk of it is cuts. And if you look at the budget, which Jeffrey Sachs actually analyzed, the economist from Columbia, looked at Obama's budget, compared it to the Ryan budget, and said they're basically going the same place. They both have the same targets for Medicare and Social Security. They have the same target for non-security discretionary spending, that is for education, housing, job training, all the rest. They're both talking about the same thing. So, this is a bipartisan problem. Now, the truth is, and this is the good news, we don't need that austerity for all kinds of reasons. The biggest problem is jobs and the economy. Once the economy recovers, we have the revenues we need to disappear the debt, particularly when you add a couple of corrective measures. How did we get into debt to start with? The Bush tax cuts were actually one of the major drivers. So we need to end the tax cuts for the wealthy, and that's predominantly by creating a truly progressive income tax that's going up to the level of Carter years or even Eisenhower years and Kennedy years. Take the income tax at the level of millionaires up to the 50, 60, 70% level when you get up to $4 million a year and more. A progressive income tax, taxing capital gains as income, and putting a sales tax on Wall Street. Why should Wall Street be the only sector not paying? A half of a percent tax on Wall Street will bring in $350 billion a year. So we can recover by ending these tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires. We can recover the budget by ending these wars for oil that we don't need. And with the Green New Deal, we make those wars for oil obsolete. We can go back to a year 2000 economy, war economy, that is, when we were spending half as much and bring down the cost markedly, bring in, hundreds of billions of dollars, again, at least $350 billion every year. And in addition, we can end the Wall Street bailout. But let me mention another very important piece, which is moving to Medicare for all. This is said to save us as much as the austerity plan. It will save us trillions of dollars over the coming decade by preventing this massive growth in health care costs. And the way that it does it is by ending the massive wasteful health insurance bureaucracy. Instead of 30%, of every healthcare dollar going into red tape, it will be 3%, and ending medical inflation, which is the biggest driver of rising healthcare costs. And that goes away under a single-payer system. So there is actually no problem at all dealing with the national debt if we do the right thing. And the Green New Deal is at the core of that because it enables us to stop the wars for oil and downsize the military. It contains the tax reforms that will tax the wealthy. And it also includes health care as a human right through Medicare for all, which will save us trillions of dollars. And in addition, by creating a true infrastructure for health through green energy, food, and active transportation, it can massively decompress our healthcare expenditures, which are now $2 trillion a year, if you add up public and private costs, it's $2 trillion a year. 75% of that can be avoided by keeping people healthy, by not making us sick to start with through pollution and sick food and a passive transportation system. So we could potentially recoup $500 billion, even $1 trillion a year by having a true healthcare system, not the sick care system that we have. So it's actually no problem. The real problem here is just waking up our friends. And, I tell people I'm now practicing political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses if we're going to fix everything else that ails our economy and our school systems and and our trade deficit and all that. We're going to fix everything else that ails us. We've got to fix that sick political system first. But part of being, you know, not politics is for every one of us to think like a political therapist and help our friends who are stuck in an abusive relationship, in this case, an abusive political relationship. And one of the hallmarks of being in an abusive relationship is apologizing for your abuser. And so many people are saying the excuses like, oh, the Republicans made him do it, or, oh, it's going to get better next year. He didn't really mean it. He loved me in his heart. You know, it's really important to look at the walk, not the talk. The talk, the walk really shows clearly where we've come and where we're going under this president, too, that, in fact, it's the politics of fear that has delivered everything we're afraid of. The real solution here is reclaiming the politics of courage, which has always moved us forward, whether it's the achievements of the labor movement, women's right to vote, the abolition movement. Mm-hmm. All of that had an independent political party as well as a social movement on the ground. And it's those two working together that becomes an unstoppable force change history. It's all about our standing up and unleashing that force right now in the voting booth on November 6th. Stand up, vote green, make your vote really mean something. To vote for Democrats or Republicans here at the presidential level is basically to give them a mandate to keep dragging you over the coals. It may not be a mandate in your mind, it might be a lesser evil vote, but the way that they will use it is to take that mandate to do four more years of the same. We are accelerating in the wrong direction.
That's
we're not
right.
just standing still. We're accelerating. We need to take our future back. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We can do that on November 6th.
Absolutely, Dr. Stein. Thank you. And I just want to commend you on your hard work. And I've noticed that it's very rare and difficult, it seems, to be a voice of conscience, a voice of reason, within the political system as we have now, a politician with actual principles and backbone. You know, I voted for Cynthia McKinney. I refuse to vote for warmongers. I refuse to vote for corporatists, no matter how bad the other guy is. And, you know, on the anniversary of the death of Paul Wellstone, we're here, you know. And I just wanted to say, how does it feel to be kind of like kind of repressed on all sides in a way from the political mainstream? And the issue of voting, I am so jaded and upset. I was not going to vote for anybody this year, but now listening to you, I think I might even get out there. Could you just tell me, strategically speaking, would my vote count? How does it count? If I show up and vote green, do we need these votes to keep the Greens on the ballot in the future? Just strategically speaking, how can we, you know, just comment on that maybe. Please.
Great questions, Kieran. Thanks so much for asking them. It's absolutely strategic. You know, every vote that is cast for a Green New Deal, for greening the economy, for stopping climate change, for bringing the troops home, every vote is life-saving and job-saving and planet-saving. It's really important to recognize the power of our vote. They have been working overtime to try to persuade us that our votes are powerless, but in fact, our votes are extremely powerful. The only weapon they have against us, we have the solutions, the facts, the truth and justice, and even public opinion on our side. All they have is psychological warfare against us. So every vote that we cast defies that psychological warfare. It defies their efforts to entrap us. And in fact, if we can break the 5% level in the vote count, mm-hmm. it means that we hit the ground running for all future partisan elections. It means we don't have to spend 90% of that race just fighting to get on the ballot. It means we're on the ballot from the get-go, and all we have to do is get the word out. Go ahead.
So let me stop you there, because, Dr. Stein, that is probably the most important thing to me that you're saying right now. Well, everything's very important, but the idea that if we get 5%, let me get this clear, of the vote, that means that we have broken the shell of the two-party system?
We've broken part of it.
Okay.
A very key and important part, and
right.
that is ballot access.
Right.
It differs by state. So some states the threshold is 5%. In some states the threshold is only 1% or 2%. Mm-hmm. So in some states it may be easier. And offhand, I don't know the requirements in New York.
Right.
But as a general rule that if we hit 5%, we are on the ballot automatically. And in addition, it gives us $20 million to start running the next presidential race.
Yeah, yeah.
That's mind-boggling what that would do for a true people-powered party.
Okay, so I think that's totally key. And for folks who are listening in Columbia Green counties, this is another big reason to go out, whether you're feeling disaffected with the other two, with the two-party system. This means that this gives us a chance, and that's what I want to see. I want to thank you, Dr. Stein, for being with us. We need to wrap up. We need to let you go. Right. Thank you for going over time. I just wanted to say,
so much.
How can folks contact who they would contact? Website or and get involved.
Great. Thank you so much. Go to jillstein.org. You can also, go on Facebook. It's just Jill Stein. And on Twitter, it's JillStein2012. And, if you are on the Internet, if you're on Facebook and Twitter, definitely get out and spread the word. If we go viral, it's going to be a very different landscape going forward. Even if we come out at 1% or 2% or 3% or 5%, it changes the political landscape,
right.
And it really puts on record that there is an opposition voice that is gathering in America that has been silenced for the past 10 years and more. It really signals an incredible shift in the political landscape. And with the way that people will continue to be thrown under the bus, as we will, because it's clear what's coming down the pike, the floodgates are going to open. It's going to continue to be a wake-up time. It's a great time to be getting involved. And after the campaign, we will be in touch. We're not going to let even a week go by before we begin to roll over and keep the momentum going and begin to focus on the next more local initiatives and building our local and state chapters to keep the momentum building. So thank you so much. We'll also continue fighting, by the way, the Commission on Presidential Debates. There is a petition on our website, which you'll see at the top of the front page on the right-hand side, Occupy the CPD, the Commission on Presidential Debates. So there's great stuff to be getting involved with. If you get our newsletter, you can forward that around and share it with your email list. It makes it easy to get the word out. So thank you for helping us turn this breaking point we face into the tipping point we need to take back our democracy and the future we deserve. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Dr. Stein.
Thank you
for
again. And don't stop doing what you're doing.
All right.
You're not kidding. To all of us.